Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a dancer.
Oh.
And when I say dancer, I'm kind of imagining myself as a dancer. I mean, I know when I was growing up, I was very inspired by ballet. And actually, I think today's guest was initially inspired by ballet, but I read a quote that he said that there was something too strict about it or something like that. And what I love about his work when I first discovered it was paintings of dancers. And in a different way to ballet, they are actually very free. There's a kind of an energy from nightclubs, perhaps. And also harking back to a kind of classic time. There's a kind of time of when dance was, I don't know, romantic and maybe glamorous and stylish and even kind of Latin or tango dancing, forms of dance that, you know, speak to times that have now gone, perhaps, but maybe that we need to bring back. And today's guest has...
I would love to see you do a tango.
We should do it. I would love that.
I'm not doing a tango with you, mate.
No, I mean, we should do dance classes or something. That would be really fun. And today's guest has also curated the summer exhibition 2023 at the Royal Academy in Burlington House in Green Park. And it's really worth heading over there because there's some extraordinary artists' works there from the late Phyllida de Barlow, our dear friend, who was also a Royal Academician like today's guest. And I really personally love Richard Malone's dramatic mobile installation, which is in the kind of main central hall. And even Joe Lycett, who was a previous Talk Art guest, and Hugh Locke and Tracy Emin and Barbara Walker, Lindsay Mendick. So many people. Yeah.
Yes.
And Caroline Walker. So we obviously have very similar taste to today's guest. So we would we're very, very proud to speak to him because he's been working for over 5 decades and his work is just extraordinary. And I hope today's episode will introduce him to even more people. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, David Renfrey.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Russ. Lovely to be on Talk Art.
We're very, very proud to have you here, David. So after your name is the letters RA, which are very important. Well, you are chief coordinator, the curator for the summer exhibition, as Rob said, and you are an RA. What does having the letters RA after your name mean?
When I was younger, I appended other words to them. You know, you can imagine I was very disparaging about the Royal Academy. Not just because I couldn't get in it, but I thought it was full of some stuffy people. We're talking about 50, 60 years ago. You know, it was very traditional in a way, but it has, don't get me wrong, there were still some really good artists in it, but it has really moved with the times. We still haven't got enough women in it, despite the best efforts of like-minded people to do that.
So even though it was something that you disparaged, you did feel like it was something that you wanted to be a part of?
Not initially, no. No, no. I really thought it was... I really wanted to be in the summer show because I stood a chance of selling work in the summer show. But quite a lot of artists refused to be in it. Now I'm honoured to be in it. I was honoured to be in it when I was actually asked about 16, 17 years ago.
And also, you're not just an RA. Aren't you now like a senior RA? Isn't there like a kind of different level which has happened more recently for you?
It's the level where people take your chair out into the forest and leave you.
You have to find your way back.
Yes, yeah. It's senior means that you're usually not so participating in the running of the show. So it was an extraordinary surprise to me when Rebecca, our lovely president, rang up and said, I mean, I'd previously been in the car 3 days before saying to Karen, well, may as well forget about that one. I'll never go to coordinate summer exhibition now. I'm 80. And 3 days later, the phone rang and it was Rebecca saying, we are hoping you'll say yes to this, but would you like to curate the summer exhibition? You can have a few days to think about it. And I said, I don't need 3 days or whatever. Yes, I'd love to. So there you go.
You manifested it, David.
I manifested it.
So what does that entail then, being the chief curator, coordinator of the summer exhibition? How long do you have to think about it? And what is the kind of pressures and the ambitions that you have to have for that?
Within 24 hours, I knew pretty much what I wanted to do with it. The pressures are high. That it's really rewarding. You get to choose your team. I wanted more women on the team. I'm not banging a drum here. It's just that only a third of us are women. But because they're so successful, they've all done it before, or they're having exhibitions in the, you know, Venice or the Tate or somewhere like that, it's hard to get a team. So it's 50-50 this year. And four of the people that I got to choose were new academic, had never done it before. Three of them were new academicians and one had never done it before. So it was a really, if I lightly use the word, virgin team, but fantastic.
And the title that you selected is called Only Connect, and that is from an E.M. Forster book. Can you speak a bit about why that quote?
Firstly, I loved that book, and the title came to me within 24 hours of being asked to do it. I think we, despite our ability to communicate with each other worldwide, instantaneously, we're more disconnected than we've never ever been. There are more kind of anti-this, anti-that. I mean, I don't mean people who are against, you know, climate change, or I don't mean that sort of thing, but people who are against other people because they're different. I'm for the embracing love of humanity, basically. You know, I want it to be very diverse and I wanted it to be very egalitarian.
I really like the fact that's from Howard's End. You know, it's this kind of connection with art and literature. And also, even like we mentioned earlier in your work, there's often references to other art forms, even though it is a painting, you know, a watercolor, like references to dance as well. But is that something that you're also interested in, like meeting of different disciplines?
Absolutely. I don't see walls between any version of the arts, nor any, you know... dances, you mentioned in your intro, Robert, you know, about dance. I've loved dance from when I was in Hull, you know, when I was growing up in Hull, you know, and I used to go to the Locarno. I lost my accent somewhere in the last 60 years. I used to go to the Locarno and the various clubs around Hull, and they were dodgy, you know, they were kind of like the grounds for, you know, knife fights, razor flight, all kinds of stuff. So you didn't really want to be sticking out like a sore thumb with a sketchbook in a corner and not participating. Are you looking at me? You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting growing up. I love Hull. I mean, I love the people of Hull. There are no better people.
So you went to Hull College. That was an art course that you started off at.
Yeah, I went to Hull College, Regional College of Art. Actually, 10 days ago, Caroline said, we're going to do a one-day trip. I'm going to drive to Hull and Beverley. And we went there. And my old art school on Anlaby Road is now a performing arts dance. So I've got back into the Northern accent, sorry. It's no longer an art school. You know, it's no longer a painting school. But Caroline's really intrepid. So, you know, she went in the door and knocked. This guy says, she said, well, this is my husband. He went to art school here. I hadn't been in the building for 60 years. This is 1963 when I borrowed an easel from Hull Art School and loaded it into a van I'd bought for 50 quid and came to London. So that was the first time I'd been in Hull Art School. It was pretty emotional. He said, you can go right up there. And there were there were people singing in different, you know, it's coming out as you were going up. Somebody should have filmed it. I know, you know, a backdrop for a daft movie, you know, but the life room was, going up into the life room, which was then empty, was an extraordinarily emotional thing for me.
And the architecture was still the same of the building.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful Victorian building. It's not unlike Camberwell School of Arts, right. Only better.
Right. And so you said that you were inspired by dancing then, but you weren't able to dance in the clubs because you might have got stabbed. So did you then work from memory at that point?
Yeah, very much so. I've approached drawing from life and drawing from memory. I'll take a picture from a newspaper. I'll do whatever it takes. But it's drawing is the foundation of it all. And I was lucky because I had a drawing professor called Gerald Harding, another northerner, and he taught me to draw at arm's length, you know. So he made me. I was the only one he made doing that at arm's length, you know. So I'd have the pencil out and draw sight size, which is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's...
What was that? So what does that give you then if you draw like that? What skill set does that build in?
Well, he said that I was... he said, be careful of your facility, David. You know, he didn't want me to be too smart-ass about, you know, drawing. I had to work at it. I think it just grounded me a bit.
So did you have like a natural kind of ability to draw? Do you think he maybe spotted that you could already draw like maybe a bit more advanced than the other students?
I don't know about more advanced than the other students, but... I could definitely draw. He didn't want to make it too easy for myself, you know.
And was you always drawn to the figure then? Because people come into your work and listening now and people who know your work, it is predominantly figurative.
It has been, and it's always going to be there. But, I mean, I don't have any barriers that I can't jump over and say, and I'm going to do this. So now my work is actually... going away from figuration.
Is it?
Temporarily, you know. Who knows?
And what is it or has it been about figures and figures dancing and interacting that has been the kind of fascination for you?
Well, initially, it's a pretext for painting and drawing people in motion. You know, I like things which are slightly off kilter. I like it. So even if I'm doing a painting of a drawing of somebody, that quite often be, okay, if you left them like that, they'd fall over. You know, I like that slight discombobulation, you know.
So, and also as a medium, watercolour is a medium that you've almost exclusively worked in. Did this also come in early on in your student days?
Not at all. I actually was very disparaging about it. I thought it was, you know, like the amateurish thing. I mean, you're arrogant. I was really arrogant when I was a student. You know, I thought I knew it all. I really didn't know anything. But I think that arrogance, in a way, carries you through to the time when you realise that you're not, you know, Goya or Velázquez, you know.
but you felt you were in comparison to those at that young age.
I felt I was a contender. I was going to be a contender.
You are, but what you've created, the body of work you've created and kind of stayed with, your practice has become definitive, has become really legendary.
I'm a legend in my own lunchtime, as they are private, I would say. Watercolour came later on. You know, I was oil is the medium in which I was initially involved, and for many, many years, I got an illness called sarcoidosis. Sometime, I don't know, 1970, something like that, and I couldn't move for 6 months or more. And when I got better, I started working watercolour because it was easier.
Oh, right. So you completely froze. I'd never heard of that before.
It affects your joints and your respiratory system. But before I got that little thing, I'd been to New York and somebody had bought a few drawings of mine. And while I was getting better, I'm diving off into another place.
Oh, we love it.
I was getting better, but slowly, and I was still, you know, mostly... really slowly working. And I got a phone call from somebody saying, "Hi, this is Joan Ankrum. I'm in Los Angeles and I have a gallery. I've seen your work and we'd love to give you an exhibition." And I thought, if I say I'm sick right now, you know, the thing in my mind is that Americans have no patience. So I said, that would be fabulous. Thank you. You know, yeah. When? She said, well, we're thinking about spring, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah. But, and I, as I got better, I was working towards this show in LA. And I made a portfolio and managed to get it on the plane. They wanted to put it in the, you know, I wouldn't let it go in the hold. I had a big fight to get it on the plane itself. And it was massive, you know. And when I got there, I thought, why? I got did I get a taxi or did I hire a car? Anyway, one way or another, I got into LA and they were supposed to meet me at the gallery, but the gallery is locked up. And so I thought, oh, what the hell am I going to do? So I walked up the road to Sunset Boulevard. I found a motel and this woman was sitting there behind the grill and she had a pistol on the grill. And I said, do you have a room? She said, yeah. So far. And she said, oh, by the way, put a chair by the door handle when you go in there. So I thought, oh, shit, you know, this is so... But when I woke up, I was in what they call Boys Town, actually. And when I looked out the window and there was a sports car and there were four guys in it. And two guys jumped out, kissed the guys in the car, and the car sped off. And I thought, God, this is amazing. This could never happen in Britain. This
in
is
Hull.
Amazing.
This never happened in Hull.
Well, not in, no, probably not.
So that show was 1980. And what was it like then for you going from, you know, the UK to Hollywood, essentially? Like,
it was a dream, actually, because the show sold out before it was even on the wall. They put the works on the floor to choose the mouldings of the frame because Joan Ankrum said, nobody in Hollywood buys anything unless it's got gold leaf around it. So, you know, so they had to choose these horrible mouldings to get around. Anyway, sold out. And Sidney Poitier was at the movie and he said he wanted something. He said, I'm going to have to meet you off the plane next time to buy something. And I thought, Jesus, I'm in a dream, you know. I met Vincent Price and Coral Brown, and Coral Brown said, "I've got a friend you'd love to paint her. She's got a face like a marmoset," and she meant Joan Rivers. So I got to paint Joan Rivers. Yeah.
So was this the first time you were making money from selling your art, like seriously?
It was the first time I was making serious chunks of it. Yeah, and it was good. It felt really good.
What everybody knows about you, who knows you, is that you are one of the residents of the Chelsea Hotel for many years, at a really kind of formative time through the 90s, through when New York was so rough and scary. And you're talking about LA, where you were then terribly scary. You have to put a chair behind the door in case someone tries to kick it in. Can we talk about, you know, the impact of America on you and your practice, but also the Chelsea Hotel, like the legacy of this?
It's really weird that I turned to America rather than Europe, where the center of painting culture arguably is. You know, the impact was enormous. New York I just fell in love with it. The first time I went there, I thought, geez, this is a fantastic, fantastic place. And I've never felt scared, even when I've been in very rough bits of New York. I've never felt uneasy about it. But Chelsea Hotel, I was mentioning to a friend that we were going there, and he said, don't ever say I recommended it. But he said, I stayed at the Chelsea Hotel for a couple of years. And Stanley Barr, you want to be in touch with Stanley Barr, try it, you could try that. So I rang Stanley Bard, and he said, yes, just get here. You know, he said, I'll talk to you when you get here. So we got there with 17 pieces of luggage, no reservation. And he interviewed me in the morning and he said, so David, how much do your paintings sell for? And I said, well, roughly this, Stanley. And he said, and how many do you paint a year? And then he showed us this room, which had just been renovated, which we lived in, and I rented a studio somewhere else.
And the Chelsea Hotel is actually a hotel. You can stay there for a night, but it's also residences, right? There's so many artists that are, over the years, like famous writers, artists and thinkers like Mark Twain, Dylan Thomas, Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Patti Smith, Valerie Solanas, who shot Warhol, Robert Mapplethorpe, Jack Kerouac.
Honestly.
The list is incredible. Why?
Recently, your friend Russ, Rufus Wainwright.
Rufus Wainwright. What is it about that building, and why are so many people flocked there?
It was built originally in the 1883, but with artists in mind. So the top floor has got studios, you know, the studio height ceilings. And it's always been friendly to artists, and they've always gone there, you know. I don't know what it is about it, but it's very embracing. If my studio hadn't been flooded, we'd still probably be there.
So is that why you came back? Because you went there in 1995 and you left there in 2016. Did you leave in 2016 because of the flooding of the studio?
Yeah, basically. They wanted us out because it had been, it's a tedious story, I won't go into it, but it had been bought by developers who wanted... He wanted the people out, basically, so that they could make it into a swish place.
I saw a documentary on it called Dreaming Walls, which I think was about this renovation and about how the residents there were under kind of attack to be like, trying to get pushed out, and they were trying to up the prices and everything. But I think there's a lot of original residents still there.
Oh, I think there are about 40 still there. Actually, Ethan Hawke made a beautiful film called Chelsea Walls. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And that was back in the day when he was there.
I haven't seen that one. I've always been struck by it as a location because of the kind of collective creative consciousness that I think is within that building. And I've always thought it's like a really romantic thing on a kind of almost like spiritual plane or something, as mad as that sounds. But I think there's almost like a vibration that happens because so
like a
much
ley
great,
line or
great,
something. Yeah.
Great stuff has happened there, like great creativity. And I think there's something about artists all being together in like that kind of community so closely, living, breathing, sleeping, all that stuff.
I think that you're right, Robert. But I don't know that we interacted that much with one another. I mean, but the fact that you were there and there were others around you doing with the same purpose, if you like, you know, was lovely. Ethan lived there for quite a time, and he became a pal, and Dee Dee Ramon lived there.
Oh yeah, she was your neighbour, right?
Dee Dee was one floor down. He gave me a tip. He said, if somebody annoys you, he pours Coca-Cola underneath their door to encourage the cockroaches to go in.
Oh my God! That's so naughty.
Yeah, well, he was very funny and quite naughty.
Oh wow! I think there's something about being an artist when it's so solitary, but you almost need to be left alone. But it's quite comforting to know there are people on the other side of the walls doing a similar pursuit.
Just as mad as you are. Yes.
You mentioned Ethan Hawke then, who was there, and Ethan Hawke has appeared in a series of your works, which mean a lot to me because I have a dog, and this body of work, which sadly is just closed at the Rugby Art Gallery Museum. It was a solo show called We Think the World of You, and it's people and dogs drawn together, and one of them is Ethan and his dog, and it's this amazing exploration of the relationships that develop between dogs and their owners, and I am one of those dogs and owners, and have that absolute, you know, this is an ongoing series of works that you started about 15 years ago.
It's not ongoing, but it's finite. You have to have a finite thing because otherwise you become the dog painter, you know. And it was really lovely. It was never intentional. It was actually started with drawing Alan Cumming, who was in Cabaret at the time. And I met him through Anna Friel, who was in another play simultaneously.
Closer. She was in Closer.
Closer.
Yeah.
Who's fabulous. We were in Joe Allen's or somewhere in New York, but I didn't know Allen. And she said, "Well, I'll introduce you." So I said, "I'd love to do a drawing of you." And he said, "Sure, sure." Of course, these things don't happen immediately, but a mutual friend reintroduced us, and he came to sit for me. And the first time he came to sit for me, it's brilliant because he had all that energy from cabaret about him. And the second time he had a dog with him called Honey, who was a rescue dog that somebody had given him. And it just made, it was a kind of interaction with two people, you know, not two people, well, it is two people, you know. The drawing process was more enlivened by that, and I really loved it. And so through that, we thought, oh, there's another person with a dog. So that's how it just grew like that.
I think for me, it's this direct communication with another species, which is this kind of miracle, I think, happens. But you make eye contact. Like I'm actually looking at Rocky now, and I make eye contact with him, and he looks at me, and I know exactly what he's thinking and what he wants. It's magic. But this whole, you know, this series, the Alan Cumming painting is beautiful. Ethan Hawke, there's a collector and philanthropist, Agnes Gund, yeah. Susan Sarandon. How did you get Susan Sarandon? How did that happen?
Well, that was probably a talk that Susan was giving, and I went along to it, and she was talking about being in Italy, and she said, you know, she didn't believe in all this people trying to have babies. She said all you have to do is go to Rome and hang out on the Spanish Steps, you know, you'll soon get pregnant.
Good advice, yeah.
something like that. Off,
yeah. Yeah, I'm booking a flight now, David. Yeah, I'm off. I am off. Yeah.
Anyways, she's hilarious. She is so subversive. Just one of the funniest and loveliest people.
When people sit for you, how long do they normally sit? Do you normally finish a portrait or a work within one sitting if you have a sitter?
I know. I always lie to them because I know it's always going to be longer than they will tolerate if I say how long it's going to be. Aggie Gunn sat for me for over a year.
A year? So how many visits would that be?
Oh, at about, you know, probably 24.
Wow. And then each sitting, how long would that be for?
About 2 hours, something like that. 2 hours more, maybe more.
No, and that would be one work, or would that be like a series?
Well, it'd be little drawings in my sketchbook and drawing, and then something. Then I'll work on larger things. She had two dogs.
And what do you do then? So if the dogs move, because obviously a human, you can tell them what to do and they'll do it. And you know, if a dog's well trained, they'll do it to a certain extent. But for 2 hours, that's ask.
No, they won't. Well, I have a reasonably good memory, but it's doing these things over and over again. You get it. I draw dogs in the park. I don't do it anymore. You know, you can get a reputation.
But this is a book that you made as well. So if anybody wants to buy that, it's We Think the World of You, People and Dogs Drawn Together by David Renfrew. And I think it's available. I think the RA published it, didn't they? I think
they
it's
did. They republished it too.
Great. Right. Everybody run out and get that. It's beautiful.
David, I'm really curious. So you found watercolour as a medium kind of out of necessity because of your then illness. But is it, it must be so different working with watercolour, because isn't it more easy to sort of move around, you know, to travel with watercolour? Because I'm imagining it's smaller materials to carry around than it would be if it was oil paints.
I don't know, because when I'm working, some of the watercolours that, I don't know if you've got the watercolour from the last exhibition, but some of those works they can be up to 15 feet across.
Oh yeah, you know,
so I'm not using watercolour in the usual, you know, the ways. I use it quite cavalier, in a cavalier way. I have really virtually no technique whatsoever. You know, I let gravity do the work mostly. You know, I always work upright. I don't work flat.
Oh, so you'll pin paper to like a studio wall and work that way?
Yeah, I've got great big sheets of hardboard and I put them on with clips all the way around and stuff like that.
And what does large scale give you? And you saying you've got no like you can't work out the style of what you do, but I'm sure there's other watercolour specialists, because you're part of the Watercolour Society now, surely. Is there people there that go, oh, this is your technique? They tell you what it is.
No, I don't really know what a technique is. I draw instinctively. I don't bother to work out stuff. I think early days, I was very influenced by people like Francis Bacon. And actually, African art was a big influence to me. And the German Expressionists were influenced. From drawing's perspective, completely different. Ang, you know, the line of Ang. And also Lippi's, Filippino Lippi. My influences are very diverse.
Mm. For me, it's always been a feeling with your work. I feel like there's something about the combination of the line in terms of the drawing, but then also the watercolour, and it just creates this kind of atmosphere or kind of emotional response from me as a viewer. Is that it? Was there a moment when you sort of were early on using watercolour that you were like, oh yeah, like this is it?
It's emotional, yeah.
No, I think I was setting myself a challenge to draw things in this particular way just before and just after my illness. And because they were successful, to me, they weren't satisfying me. They weren't pleased, you know. So I didn't move from watercolour to oil at that stage, but I made visits to America encouraged me to paint on a larger scale. Arsh do a lovely paper, which is 640 grams, and I can only do it in inches, but it's 60 inches wide, which is 5 feet by about just under 40 inches high.
And this is a paper brand that you...
Yes, it's French, and it's fantastic. You can do what the hell you like with it.
And this isn't something that's going to run out, because so many people fall in love with materials and then suddenly they discontinue
especially
them.
Paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually bought the last 1,000 sheets of J. Bartram Green's double elephant rough paper because I loved it so much.
Why find that crazy that these materials just then won't exist anymore?
So I think it's discontinued.
They don't exist.
But why? Why? Because just because it's costly and there's not enough people using it, or what?
I don't know. I think sometimes we don't respect our craftspeople. You know, we respect craftspeople from other countries, but not our own. I mean, it's like Wedgwood being not made in this country anymore. I mean, just an example, but there are loads of examples I can give you.
Wow. So this large scale, why did America inspire you to go big? Because America's big, I guess. It's all like big, 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 but supersized. But why?
Because they'll buy it.
Because they will buy it big.
Yeah, they'll buy it big. They have larger spaces to put works and they'll buy it. And to be honest with you, I was doing it before I moved to America. There's a watercolour that's going to the Tate called A Little Night Music. And that was painted just before we went to America. And it's of clubs in England. It's not one particular club.
Sorry, but if you hadn't gone America then at any point, do you think your work would have been smaller scale?
Well, I don't think it would have been as extreme, because I've done about paintings which are 4 or 5 panels of that size.
Wow, it's so good.
So that's you know, because I could.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And what is it like, you know, you're a man of 80, to make work on that scale? Are you still working at that scale now?
No, I'm actually flipped back to oil again, you know, so the work in the Royal Academy this year is actually an oil, although it started out as neat little paintings of chandeliers. When I was four paintings in, I realised that it was more than that, and it was one painting and growing.
it's just so exciting that this work.
The work that you're mentioning that's going to the Tate, so when you said it's more than one club, so it's a kind of like almost like a collage of different memories from different nightclubs.
Yeah, well, I've got loads of drawings, you know, of things, and I see people, as an old, they creep in, little odd couples, odd things. What you mentioned about dancing earlier, you know, it's a pretext to paint human beings in an embrace, if you like, and moving. It's a gift, really.
I think you're quoted as saying, "I would never describe myself as a portraitist, but I'm endlessly fascinated by people."
Yeah, I think I did say that, yeah.
Correct, great. Right, that's clear. How often are you in your studio, David? What is your rules you've set for yourself?
8 hours a day. People say, you know, are you a portrait painter? I said, I always think of Ray Charles, and he says, somebody said to him, asked him if he was a blues singer, and he said, "I am not a blues singer, but I am a singer who is able to sing the blues." So that's how I think about portrait painting.
This 8 hours a day thing, it reminds me of a story I read about you, that when you first came to London, and why London was suddenly, you knew that was a destination in the late 60s. You also held down jobs, you delivered typewriters, and you were a cleaner. But then outside of that, you were dedicated to spending 8 hours a day. It's like this 8 hour thing has been a constant for you in the studio.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. Why I picked 8 hours and not seven and a half or six, but or nine. But it's a sort of time when you can get something done. You know, it's a chunk of time, and if you don't do it routinely, I don't know. I don't know what would happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes having the discipline is good, isn't it? Like, to sort of set yourself a rule of some kind.
In the end, it doesn't become a discipline. It just becomes a habit. You know, it's just, it's like eating Weetabix. If you eat Weetabix, I don't eat Weetabix, but well, I'm sure it's lovely.
Habit forming. Yeah.
How have you rode the ebbs and flows of a career for like 50 years, and also a career that's concentrating on the figure predominantly? Because when I first started collecting, me and Rob first started collecting, it's like the figuration's dead, collect the figure, nobody's in, it's all very like geometric abstraction now, it's minimalism, and now the figure is the figure. It's like, it's back in a big way. Have you really noticed these trends for yourself as a career?
Have I? yes, you're completely regarded, particularly as you're getting older. You know, you think if you're a young figure painter, it's easier because you're seen to be reinventing or coming. But as an old git, as an old guy, you know, you're it's seen as being somewhat reactionary. But you know, I don't really pay attention to what people are saying.
But you must feel fashionable now, because there's a real attention on your work and figure suddenly, and it must feel like a renaissance for the figure.
I don't know how you could think I could ever feel fashionable, Russ.
Well, hang on, but let's talk about your fashion.
He's sartorial. No, but there's a difference between fashion and sort of like personal style, and I feel like David's got incredible, precise sartorial kind of integrity.
That's very flattering. I could call it just laziness. You know, I just get the same hats from the same hat maker, and you know, I'm ashamed to say, these same trousers and, you know, same jeans rather, and they're from rather posh makers, but they fit well. And,
well, so it's more like a uniform then to work.
It's a uniform.
Well, let's talk about your trilbies, because you have a collection of trilbies. They're not called a trilby, though, are they?
I don't want to say it is. Or they all rush into Bates, but they can all rush into Bates anyway in Jermyn Street.
And how many do you have?
I probably have about 15 of them, but they're all the same.
They're all the same colour and all the same. They're called a weekender, aren't they?
Oh, now you've given it away. Now.
Oh, have I? I'm sorry. But do you need more than 15? Are you worried they're going to sell out now?
They go in rotation. You know, I think, oh, this has got a little bit knackered now. I don't tend to throw them away, which I really should do.
They should go. They're going to go to the V&A, David. They should never throw them away.
Is that because you love them, though? Like you feel a kind of tenderness towards it?
I think it's more that I find it difficult to throw anything away, Robert.
Oh, right. Interesting.
I keep things thinking that this will make, I will make something out of this, like a sculpture or something like that. Or I never will, but I mustn't say that.
Yeah, you've got to keep the possibilities open. Yeah. And also, we were talking about New York and LA earlier, and place is obviously such an important thing for you, you know, alongside the work you've created. Can we talk a bit about London and Kensington in particular, and the 40 years that you've also, you know, spent within that as a location?
Yeah, when I came to London, my cousins were living in Earl's Court in Hogarth Road, a top floor flat with five other guys. You know, it's just one of those sleazy, everybody mucks in and has a space somewhere. It was a big top floor flat. And that's when I got the job. I needed to earn money, you know. So that's when I got the job as a cleaner. The Horseshoe Hotel in Tottenham Court Road, which is now the Dominion Theatre. Yeah, that was fun.
what is Kensington? Why did you end up there?
I don't know why I gravitated to Kensington. Oh, I know about this, because I wanted to buy somewhere. I got about $2,000 or $3,000 in the building society. I was living in East Dulwich, and a guy who'd been to that first exhibition of mine in LA couldn't buy something, and he was the manager of the Grateful Dead, and he was furious that the proprietor, Joan Ankrum, had bought something for herself. He said it was unethical. Anyway, he commissioned me to do a nude portrait of his wife. He said, I would like you to do a nude portrait of Jessie, my wife. And I said, yes, I'll do that, but she has to come to London. I'm not coming here to do it. So they came to London. He had business here as well, you know, and they had to come out to East Dulwich, where I lived. And they were complaining about it, you know, and said, why don't you get a place? And I said, you know, I can't even buy a place here. I can't get a mortgage. And he said, oh, if you ever need a mortgage, ring this number. And he gives me a card with a number, and ring this number. I said, oh, okay. If you want, and he didn't say a mortgage. If you ever need to borrow money, ring this number. So anyways, I saw this place, you know, Millet's house not far on the other side, and four rooms, kitchen and bathroom, 49,000. And I thought, that's perfect light. That's got to be it. So I went to the Halifax and said what it was. I said, I work out, I can pay it back. And they said no, because I was a bad risk, self-employed. Anyways, so I rang the number and the voice said, how much do you want? And I said, 50,000. He said, what's it for? I said, to buy a flat. He said, oh, you can put a firm offer in today. You'll have the whole amount in a bank account in the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank by the middle of next week. And that's how I got started.
Is this phone number still available? Is this somewhere?
it will cost you. he's not around anymore, but he was a very fearsome person, more guns than I care to think about.
Oh, my God. And you're still in the same property now? You still have that?
I still have that now. I mean, I remortgaged after a couple of years so I could discharge his guarantee. What he did is he put the same amount in another bank in Jersey to guarantee my loan. That's all.
Wow.
And that was 1981. And I read that you've really enjoyed walking within that area. If you go on walks, does that then inspire like the people that you might see? Do you ever paint anyone that you see like around and about?
I sometimes do, somebody sticks in my mind. There was a young woman years and years ago that always took a black dog out, and she would, and you're always hesitant about sort of, you know, looking like a stalker or something like that. But she'd always hold sticks up, and this dog would jump up for it, and it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. She was always had this black coat on, a white shirt, you know, which, you know, she was very stylish in this sort of way, and the black dog. It was just gorgeous. So I made a drawing, an etching, and a painting of that, you know. So that sort of thing happens.
And she's aware that this happened?
No, she isn't aware. she saw a drawing, you know, she's not aware. I wasn't near enough to her. I didn't want her to be self-conscious.
Right.
I didn't want it to be a posed thing, which is, right. It does sound as if I'm a stalker, but recently there was a young woman sitting with seven swans around her, feeding these swans. And I actually went to her and said, "Would you mind if I took a photo of you feeding the swans?" And she said, "No."
She wouldn't let you take? She didn't want you to take?
She said, "Yes, you could."
Oh, okay,
could.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you work from photographs?
I can, and they're sometimes an aid to memoir, but they're not... I've got loads of cameras, but I never use them.
Can we talk about commissions throughout your career? And there's one in the National Portrait Gallery collection, which is of Sir John Gielgud, obviously the great actor that you made in the early 80s, which is wonderful, but also a commission that you turned down, which is of someone, and you've actually said it's a regret of yours. I'd love to hear about this story of this commission that never happened.
Yeah, I was offered. They said, "We have Margaret Thatcher is available to do," and I'm not a Thatcherite. It was at the time she forbade school milk. I mean, and my
Thatcher,
kids are in...
Thatcher, the milk snatcher.
Yeah. And I thought, I just don't want to... But I wish, with hindsight, that I had done it. Except I'd have missed out on G. Muir, who I loved.
And it's a regret now because the fact that, you know, she's a historical figure in some ways, or...
I guess so. It would have been challenging to do somebody you really don't like.
And you've never done that since of anyone? You've never...
Life's too short.
Yeah, but I like that. I like the morals. I think that's commendable, David.
Talking about G. Muir, I know you've also collaborated in the past with Stella McCartney, and you did, I really remember it, a really beautiful series of drawings for a project you did maybe in the early 2000s.
Yeah, actually, before Stella, the first person I drew in the fashion things was Sandra Rhodes.
Oh yes,
she was actually my landlady in the late 60s, I think, in Porchester Road. Okay, back to the Stella thing. I was in New York and the phone rang, and somebody said she didn't want to say who she was because she said she thought I'd hear ching ching when she said, but she had to tell me. so she said, I've seen a drawing that you did in a magazine that my dad's got, and I have found a model who looks exactly like the picture in your, would you do it? I said, I'll do it if the model comes to New York. I'm not going to come to the model. So she said, fine. And I think a little while later, maybe a week or two later, she said, the model can't come to New York. I think she may have been, was she from Ukraine? It was after 9/11, it was very hard for certain groups of people to get visas, right. And she couldn't get a visa. So Stella said, I'll put you up in Paris, I'll put you up in London, you know. So I said, all right, I'll do it. So she put me up, I thought Paris, you know, I'll never get anything done, you know, so she put me up in Dorchester, I think, in Elizabeth Taylor's old suite, which was it was enormous, the whole, almost the floor, huge. And the model arrived at 6:30 every morning, went to hairdresser.
6:30 every morning?
Yeah, something like that. And
wow.
And we worked through the whole day for a week or so.
And that was inspired by a drawing that you'd done in 1972 from the Image magazine. And it was apparently
homework.
It was apparently on the front cover at that time. And Stella had obviously seen that. In the late 90s, I think she discovered it through her dad's collection of magazines or whatever. Didn't you do a whole series of them? So it was quite a number of drawings, wasn't it?
For Stella?
Yeah.
Yeah. I did a whole slew of them, you know. Mm. And actually the V&A had a show of them. I don't know, 15 or so years ago.
Is there a book of your Stella McCartney?
There is.
Great.
I've got that book.
All right. Next book.
It's called Drawings for Stella McCartney by David Renfrey.
That's a bit of a giveaway.
It's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
So what are you working on now then? What does, you know, your day look like, and what sort of shows can we look forward to?
There are shows of previous work done, but what I'm looking forward to is bearing in mind that I haven't had a chance to really get in the studio for about 8 months. I mean, seriously. I'm working on various things. One of them is connected with an elevator shaft from the Chelsea Hotel, because in my studio there was a bathroom at which I had a window at the back of it, which was painted and sealed shut. It was frosted glass. And one day, quite late into almost, you know, a year or so before I left it, you'd scrape and open the window, which is on a swivel, and it was onto the lift shaft. And it was kind of scary looking out of it, because you couldn't actually tell when the lift was coming up. And it came up at a hell of a pace. And I was never sure if it would quite clear the window or not. But I did hang a light outside it and did a few drawings, took about 5 Polaroids.
What was the intention of the window originally then?
Ventilation? I don't know what it was. But it was pretty dangerous.
Did other people have them? Could you see, if you looked out that window, could you see other floors with them? Or?
No.
How weird. That's just like one of the mysteries of that hotel, isn't it?
It was
like,
completely bonkers.
And who would have sealed it up then? Like, I guess the building superintendent would have been like, this is dangerous, we're going to seal this up.
I don't think they had building superintendents then, but I think they thought it was probably a bad idea to have a window opened onto the...
To a lift shaft. Oh, I can't wait to see this. So where will we be able to see this body of work? Sounds fascinating.
It's ongoing now. I'm searching for the perfect black. I should really talk to Anish Kapoor, who's invented, patented...
His own black.
Yes.
Can we quickly talk about a painting which I really have loved since I first saw it in about 2020, which is called Quiet Rooms. And I think I saw it when it was the pandemic. And it's a painting of like chandeliers. That's kind of, they're almost dancing themselves. And then a woman solitary kind of sitting alone on a chair, but you don't see the front of her. It's like a side portrait of her in the right-hand corner of the painting. And I love that one so much. How did that work come about? Because it kind of is so different in a way to some of the other things you're sort of best known for.
I don't actually know how that happened. You know, there wasn't an intention to put a figure in that, but I've been drawing this model who was really beautiful and very still, and you know, she had this kind of mood about her. And so I kind of put her into this situation, this fictional place, which I'd quite, same as the dancers, you know, they're all fictions. It's like a movie. Movie isn't real, you know, unless it's a documentary. So she was there, and it was something about her. She had a kind of innate sadness to her. Mm. So I put her in there. It's now I think it's in the British Embassy in Paris.
Oh, right.
I think, yeah.
I was just really struck by the shapes of the chandeliers, because it's almost like they become human. There's some kind of like dance, but within the kind of jewel-like element of these chandeliers, because they look like almost like diamond, you know, crystal, whatever you call it, glass chandeliers. They're so gorgeous.
Oh, that's the thing that initially grabbed me about the chandeliers. They were in Soho House. The original chandeliers were in Soho House in New York. They had 6 of them. And I made this little drawing of them. Thought, I'll use that sometime. And I saw him again, made another little drawing, and didn't use it for about 6 years, because I've taken about 3 years to make this painting, you know, so.
You were saying then about earlier on about a painting entering the Tate collection and you're in the National Portrait Gallery. Do you have ambitions for other museum institutions that you would love to be part of their collections?
I think every artist wants to be in the major collections if they can. It's more difficult for me. I have gender and age against me.
Do you find that? You think that's a real thing? Do you find that?
I'm not grumbling about it. God knows white males have dominated for such a long time.
Got it. but every collect, you're like, I want to be in all the national collections. I'm happy with
that. Of course
I do,
yeah.
That's amazing. So we are going to go into our final questions now, David. This has been really wonderful. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
I've actually got two that I really love. One of them is the Annunciation, around 1443, by Fra Filippo Lippi, and it's in the Alte Pinakothek in Munich. And when I first saw it, I don't often get teary in front of paintings, but it absolutely blew me away. And I'm not religious. And it was so gorgeous. And the second one, I've made copies of. I found a model that is a satyr mourning over a nymph by Piero di Cosimo, which is in the National Gallery. And it is the most beautiful painting. It's so tender, and it has dogs in it, Russ.
Good, I'm there. You've got me. A satire and a dog, I'm in it. I love it. Have you ever traded work with other artists? And what artists have you hung out with? Did you meet Warhol?
I didn't meet Warhol. Oh, my gosh. Really, not many. I mean, Larry Rivers, met Larry Rivers. Mm-hmm. I like current artists like Lindsay Mendick.
Yes, of course.
but you're talking about American artists.
Yeah, and did you ever trade? Like, was there everything where you barter for your, rent with a painting, and did you trade with other artists?
No, it was... actually, it was always said that Stanley bartered, and he did with some, but not with us. Right. He would have, but we kept it... It's easier to keep it straight. We saw people like Arthur Miller, we saw quite regularly, because he was a friend of Arnold Weinstein. He was in all the time. There was Patti Smith, actually, came around looking for her studio one day. And I'm pretty sure that my studio was where she and Robert Mapplethorpe lived. René Ricard, who did work with Warhol. He was one of the very handsome young men, and he was a great pal. Herbert Gentry, Abdullah Ibrahim from Dollar Brand, Zaldi Goko, who designed the clothes for Michael Jackson. Drew Straub was a neighbor who actually moved to New York with Keith Haring. Richard Bernstein, who did all the cover, all of that. There were quite a lot of people. I don't even remember the names.
Were there, in terms of your line, when you were growing up and you were drawing and developing your own language as an artist, were there people that had kind of pushed you forward or inspired you? Because even if I think of that Stella book, Egon Schiele comes to mind in terms of some of the positions of the body shapes and things like that. But were there other people that inspired you?
Yeah, when I went to art school, just at that time, I became aware of these people. I wasn't previous to that. Egon Schiele was never a real inspiration to me, but I admired it immensely, but he wasn't. But there were plenty of other artists that did. But they were usually earlier artists. I loved Daumier, the painter. He did political cartoons, but he also, his painting is beautiful. His actual painting was the influence. He was about the same time as Manet, perhaps.
Pretty like mid-1800s, no?
Yes, yeah.
Cool. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
That's so hard, you know. If it was in nature, it would be that time when the there's a sort of a darkish pale blue and there's a yellowy pink that creeps into, and there's a kind of middish colour. But if you want tubes of paint, then I'm going to say it's between sap green, Harding sap green, or cadmium red deep. I'll go for the cadmium red deep.
And what is the brand then of paint that you use? Is there a certain brand that you're loyal to?
Harding's oil. I haven't, because Winsor & Newton sold out, I haven't yet found a watercolour that suits me.
Oh, so that they discontinued the watercolour that you liked?
Yeah, I think they make it somewhere else and it's not the same.
So interesting. But Harding's oil paints you're happy with. So where do you get so Harding's also make the watercolours?
They're starting to make watercolours and I haven't tried them yet, but I will surely.
But you've still got enough left over from Winsor & Newton?
I always need more.
And all your 1,000 sheets you've cleared out. Some poor artist somewhere else is going, there's no paper left. Someone bought 1,000 of them.
Well, you know, they were there. They could have bought them.
Yeah. Also, if anybody's got any tubes of that colour that you need, maybe they can send them in the post to Kensington.
it actually goes hard, you know, because it hardens up sometimes in the tube. But, you know, life goes, there's always another colour. There's not always another manufacturer, I'm sure.
What's the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
It actually comes from Filippo Lippi too, and it's a line every day. And he didn't mean Coke.
that's amazing advice, yeah, from the Chelsea Hotel. Yes. Go on and explain that.
Well, it's draw every day, basically. That's it. When I got an honorary doctorate from Lincoln University a few years ago, completely undeserved anyway, I got this thing in, and they asked me to give a piece of advice to students. I said, students don't want to hear advice from some old person. But however, I'll tell you two things that work for me. One is practice your whatever it is that you do every day. If you're a writer, write every day. If you're an artist, draw. Dancer, dance, you know, whatever it is. And the second thing is practice kindness. I've found kindness to be the single most self-rewarding and rewarding to others that you can possibly imagine.
I love that. When did that become something like of a mantra for you?
When I grew up, which was probably in my 50s.
Right. So in your 50s, you felt that kindness was a really, was an asset, really, that you could share.
I'd had it before, but I've been, you know, on my journey.
Well, I mean, that's something that I'm really, you know, be kind. It's a real important thing, whatever we're doing, whoever's listening, whatever world you're in.
What about being kind to me, hun?
No, apart from you, I'm not going to do the tango with you, and I'm not going to be kind to you. But no, I will. If you want to do a tango, Rob, we can do it.
For everyone listening, I am very excited because in 2025 there's going to be a big retrospective of yours at the Beverly Art Gallery. Is that right?
Yes, there is going to be a retrospective. It's going to be relatively, you know, it fit in the space there. And I'm really, really chuffed about it. I love Beverly. It's a beautiful, beautiful little town. And
yeah, it's East Riding.
Of Yorkshire.
Yeah.
God's country.
Going back to your roots. No, that's very exciting. Oh. Well, this has just been so wonderful. I'm glad we finally, really glad, thrilled we finally got to connect with you and talk about this. And the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition that we talked about earlier, that you chief coordinated, that is going on until the end of summer, which I guess is, do we know an end date?
I think it's probably got a couple more weeks to go.
Oh, really? Is it only because we're in? Yeah, okay. So we're in the beginning of August now. So
it goes until the 20th of August.
Okay.
Ah, you see.
Right.
What is next for you apart from the Beverly? Are you working on other exciting projects?
Well, they're exciting to me. I'm just longing. I've got loads of canvases ready to go. They're a nail to the wall. You know, I'm out there.
And people can find you on Instagram at David Renfrey RA.
I believe so.
Yes, and also you can go to davidrenfrey.com, which is an official website, and it has links and also a really beautiful biography. And I love the portrait of you, actually. It was taken in the Chelsea Hotel, and I think it was taken by Dudley Reed, and it's actually become part of the National Portrait Gallery collection itself.
Oh. Every day is a school day.
And there's also some really wonderful books, not only the one that I mentioned earlier about Stella McCartney, but there's We Think the World of You, People and Their Dogs Drawn Together as a book, and also one called Dancers. And if you search the internet, you will find some beautiful books, so I really recommend those too. David, it's been such an honour to speak to you, and thank you for your generosity and just your collaborative spirit, because I think, you know, you mean a lot to the artist community at large. And you know, I know you mentioned Lindsay Mendick earlier, who's a good friend of mine, and I know she adores you, and it's so great the way you're giving encouragement to the next generation as well. I think you're such a supportive
I should have mentioned others. I should have I mean, oh, there are so many.
All you've got to do is go to the Royal Academy show and you'll see them all, because you've included lots of new voices.
That's right.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And the words of David Renfrey, practice kindness, everybody, and we'll be back very soon.
Practice
you,
kindness, Russell.
Apart from
we'll be
Rob.
Back very soon.
Bye, David. Take care.
Bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.